Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Chris Peeks. I'm here with longtime insurance agent Jim Murphy and a former member of the House of Representatives. He has agreed to come on today to give me an interview, and I'm very thankful for that. Had some questions about what goes on really in Montgomery and the things that goes on in day-to-day life. Jim, thanks for coming on and giving me this opportunity. How are you today?
I am doing very well, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you and do the interview. Looking forward to it.
So, Jim, what motivated you to get into politics?
Early in my life, my dad used to take me to political campaigns, even as a very young child. And some of my earliest memories of that would go all the way back to the Wallace Brewer election back in, I believe it would have been 1970. So I was always intrigued by the campaign process and campaigns and just the energy of the campaigns and the people involved and the politicians. So that kind of sparked my interest and just began to observe and see things and begin to pick up bits and pieces of information along the way that just really sparked my interest and got involved behind the scenes with helping various different political candidates at, it's in the state at various levels, county and state levels.
So just a quick question. What did you think about that Wallace Brewer race? Because I read a book where it was the most dirtiest race in American political history.
Well, likewise, I've heard that too, but you got to understand I was 8 years old then, so I don't remember a lot of the detail of it. And I've read it. I would have to refresh my memory as to the specifics of all the allegations and who did what and why it was perceived to be such a dirty, negative campaign. But I do remember a lot of talk about that, but I don't remember any of the specifics.
My first one, I guess I really kept up with, was the one that kind of changed the state, the Baxley-Graddock fiasco in 86. I don't know how long Alabama would have held on being a Democratic state, but, you know, it didn't really help the matters.
Yeah. Well, that would be a campaign that I observed in and participated in back in 86. I first got back in Onion after college, actually in 85. And back then, I think it's still true today that each gubernatorial candidate would appoint someone within each county to be their county coordinator for the campaign. And back then, Bob James appointed my dad as county chairman, and my dad in turn turned right around and handed it to me, said, "Here, you're Bob James, county coordinator." And I said, "Yes, sir," and took it and ran with it. And just learned a lot by doing that, you know, help administer the James campaign, coordinate volunteers, put out signs, and just the general campaign type things, and organize some events, and had get Bob up here a time or two. And one of those occasions actually included an event down at the Agribusiness Center here in Onondaga. And back in those days, 86, people actually went to political rallies. You know, they had a big political rally there, and there's 400 or 500 people there. You had Ronnie Flippo running, Charlie Graddock, Bob James, Bill Baxley. I think McMillan, I think George McMillan was running too. You had about 5 or 6 candidates.
McMillan did. I think Flippo actually ran in 90.
Okay.
Yeah, but George McMillan got in that race too. Yeah, you're correct on that.
So, I do stand to be corrected on these names, absolutely. I do remember seeing Flippo down at the Agribusiness Center. That could have been another rally at another date. But this particular occasion, I met Lucy Baxley and kind of hit it off with her, developed a really good rapport, and she was kind of kidding around with me, saying, "Jim, whenever we win this election, you know, Baxley in this primary, I want you to come and work for us." And I said, "Oh, no, Lucy, y'all are not going to win. Bob's going to win. And when Bob wins, I want you to come to work for us." And we kind of joked around and nodded our heads, said, "Yeah, sure." So anyway, Baxley won or got in the runoff if you remember.
He won 36%. The way it broke down, Baxley had 36% of the vote coming out of the primary. Graddick had 29, and Fobb was at 23, and McMillan was at 12.
Yeah. So you remember that well. I would have had no idea what the order was or the percentages. I just knew that Graddick and Baxley were in the runoff. But so I received a phone call from Lucy literally probably a day or two after. And she said, Jim, all right, I want you to come work for me. So back then I did. And I was Lucy's driver, schedule coordinator, and all those things that went with it. And her and her friend Marty Dillard, who was a part of the campaign too, traveled with her. I literally drove them just about everywhere they went, all over the state, and kind of coordinated with the people that we're going to meet in the meeting points and setting up meetings and that thing. So that was a great experience. And so that was all throughout that Baxley Graddick campaign runoff, contest of the runoff, the overturning of the runoff, and then the general election leading up to Guy Hunt getting elected. So that was a very interesting and fun time and very valuable experience, for sure.
What do you think about, because even as a kid, I understand the argument that was made, illegal crossover voters, but as a kid, I remember thinking, this isn't fair. I know that they closed primaries or something, but the guy won. I mean, you stripped it from him, you know, because these people crossed over and voted. And I know that was against the bylaws, but to me, that just didn't seem fair to me even as a kid.
Well, it's an easy sell because the public doesn't really understand the legalities of the election, of a primary. You know, if you, this is a primary, this is not the general election, which I understood it at that time. I think the Republican Party has open primaries and runoffs, and runoff is just an extension of the primary, the initial vote, and I understood it, but it'd be real easy to confuse the public put it out there like, hey, you're losing your right to vote, which is essentially what happened.
I believe. See, I even at that age, I understood it too, but I can remember my grandfather, who was born in 1930, and he voted for Graddick. And, of course, like most Southerners here, the first Republican he ever voted for was Reagan in 84. Mm-hmm. But he was absolutely livid. Mm-hmm. I'm voting for Hunt. I mean, yeah. And everybody I talked to, and then it was like everybody woke up the next day and was like, who's Guy Hunt?
Yeah. Right.
And there are some things that, you would think that, uneducated man from Coleman didn't do anything, but, he was actually one time voted one of the most progressive governors in Alabama, and I remember his campaign slogan, he had a great one in 1990, moving us forward, making us proud.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of think he got a raw deal about, them going after him. I've seen...
All that stuff. I don't remember all the details, I don't have a great opinion about it.
It was, he took some inauguration money that was left over and spent on his farm, and had some prisoners work on his farm, and took a love offering when he was preaching. And I'm like, guys, if y'all going after him for this, everybody in politics needs to be in federal prison right now.
Right. Yeah.
So you ran in for the executive committee in 1992, is that correct?
No, I just remained involved in politics, throughout the remainder of the 80s and into the 90s. And, the state Democratic Party at that time had a state executive committee. I'm not sure if it's still structured this way or not, but you had two people from within each county that were elected to the state Democratic Executive Committee. And in 92, I was elected as one of those people.
So going into 94, what made you think that Representative Harvey was vulnerable?
It wasn't so much that. It's just that I had an interest in running and felt like I knew the position, felt like I knew the people, knew enough about campaigning, and that I felt like I could do it. And that's why I chose to do it. You know, I wanted to run, wanted to, you know, represent the people of Blount County. I wanted to represent the more conservative type values of Blount County. So I just structured my campaign and ran it and won. It wasn't as much as looking at the vulnerability of the incumbent.
What do you think led to your victory? Do you think you outworked him? Do you think he didn't take you serious?
Combination of those two things, yes, but there's a lot more to it than that. I think just a high energy campaign, a personal touch campaign, a grassroots campaign, which all those things relate to work, a different type of campaign, a more personable approach as opposed to a media type approach, aggressively asking people, looking them in the eye and asking them for their vote, and tell them I need their help. And they responded.
In a race like that, you know, you have to raise money in that. And of course, things have changed today as far as money. How much did a race like that cost your campaign?
Back then, I structured a $10,000 campaign.
Wow.
So in 94, I knew if I could raise that much money, I made a commitment not to spend any of my own money, because I was kind of taught that if you couldn't raise the money, it was a pretty good indication as to your electability. So I made a list of 100 people that I knew could give me $100 if they wanted to. And I didn't even get halfway through the list, I'd raise my $10,000. So once I had that, I organized a campaign, or began to work with campaign, and you know, some other money came in, but then, you know, after I won the primary, it was just pretty easy.
Yeah, so. As I was looking at his returns, you defeated him pretty handily in that.
I think it's about 60-40 at that, something like that. Yeah,
I've been talking to Troy King. I was thinking of running for a race and that, and he told me the same thing. He said, about raising money, he said, you know, call, you know, 200 people you know, ask them for $50, ask them for $500, ask them for whatever they can give, and stuff like that. And you mentioned Mr. McMillan a while ago. I'm good friends with George. I've known him for years. And he is a very, I don't know how well you know Mr. McMillan, but he's a very sharp man when it comes. Mm-hmm. And he told me all kind of advice. He said, find out who their donors are, come back and tell me. And he said, we'll go from there.
Yeah.
You know, he would have been, I think he would have been a great governor, you know, if times had came. It just wasn't his time. And because I've talked to George a lot of times, and George said, great ideas about what he wanted to do for the state. I actually have a flyer with George when he was running in 82 against Wallace, and it said, we don't have 4 years to waste, mm-hmm. which I thought was a great slogan in there.
Yeah.
So you go on, and I didn't really, who did you run against in 94 for, who was the GOP candidate?
Dennis Martin,
okay. I don't really call that a name. So you get into Montgomery. This is, I guess, maybe a shock to you, maybe you're not. What were you expecting? I mean,
well, I've been an observer long enough to know a good deal about it, who the players were and how things worked there. I had been to Montgomery many times previously as in a capacity as not a registered lobbyist or anything, but just lobbying for insurance type affairs with our statewide association. We have an annual legislative conference that I participated with. So I knew, plus I'd been involved in a lot of campaigns, so I knew who some of the players were and a little bit about the process. You know, I ran a campaign in 94 with the slogan, putting ethics first. And you know, Fob James got elected in 94 also, essentially same theme. And the very first bill that was introduced and passed was an ethics reform bill that I felt like I was somewhat responsible because I met with Governor James right after we both got elected, and we discussed, you know, how we got elected and what some of the things were and some of the priorities of our agenda, et cetera. And we had that mutual priority of ethics. And so, you know, his administration came out with a bill, which initially I supported. The way that works is, you know, there's a bill out there and a lot of people are in agreement, but there's one person that's kind of designated the sponsor, and then you kind of generate some co-sponsors. And initially I was going to be a co-sponsor, but I opted out when they kind of gutted the bill, some significant things that I felt like ought to be in there. But I was very instrumental, I believe, in getting some ethics reform being the very first thing passed in that quadrennium. And that met with my slogan of putting ethics first. I was very involved with some welfare reform legislation that I think has really saved the state a lot of money from the time it's been enacted. We had what was called the New Hire Act, which enabled certain governmental entities to cross-reference each other to make sure there weren't duplicate payments with like workers' comp insurance and unemployment insurance and other benefits that people might be getting, you know, from a fraudulent standpoint. A lot of workers' comp fraud was going undetected. A lot of unemployment payment fraud was going undetected. And once this was implemented, a lot of that stopped, resulting in a lot of savings to the state, millions of dollars. So that was a pretty significant thing. We had rural telephone service back then. We still do today. I was involved and sponsored legislation that enabled the smaller rural companies to have a fair competitive playing field on some things that were not unfair, mostly related to financing, and public financing, et cetera. Those are some examples of some of the things that I did, significant bills that I was involved in the past. So,
do you think that was your signature piece of legislation?
I would call the New Hire Act signature piece, yes.
Sorry to jump back a while ago. I've always wondered this question. Do you think that Governor James actually liked governing, or that he just liked being on the trail on the campaign? It seemed like he felt in his element and he loved campaign, but once he got into office, maybe he just...
Well, the way I see it, and got a good analogy now with Trump having get elected, his personality, not as brash as Trump, but the way he ran things and the way he looked at things, the way he communicated about things, very similar to Trump, but it was back in 1994. So it wasn't well received with the traditional political community. You know, if you came to me and said you needed something done, but in my mind I knew I couldn't do it, Bob would say, "No, I'm sorry, I can't do that. See you later." But you know, a typical politician will pretend like, "Hey, yeah, I'll pat you on the back. I'm gonna try. I'm gonna do this," and lead you to believe that possibly there's something you can do. So Bob was very direct, but you know, very honest and very genuine in his approach, but it just didn't meet your traditional mode of political norms for communication, operations, et cetera.
He was very
conservative. I mean, he would call a spade a spade, and didn't really want to, didn't tolerate much political shenanigans that happened, and called them out, you know. So much like Trump, frankly. So
I mean, I love Fob. I mean, he was so gregarious. I would say that one of the last colorful Southern governors we ever had. I mean,
he had a very businesslike approach. You know, most of those guys have spent years cultivating their political personality, and you know,
he's so gregarious. I mean, yeah. I don't think he took himself too serious, and And I think Paul, probably would have did better in. I think the last race he was just tired. He just wanted out of it. But the media was so far against so against Bob, much like they was Trump. And I can understand the rage in Trump's face sometimes, because if it was portrayed what Trump was actually doing instead of the spin that the media put on it, people would realize what this man was actually trying to accomplish for the nation. I mean, at the time the media gets a hold of it, and people, I hate to say it, but I don't think that the average voter, people who keep up politics, they don't know anything, and whatever CNN tells them, they go with it. So you went through 4 years in the legislature, and you come into 98, and you are going to face Ellen Thomas. Going into that race, it started in January. Did you feel like you would be reelected, or did you feel like that the winds of change had started to?
Well, I knew the winds of change were starting. A lot of that stemmed from folks out of Jefferson County moving into Blount County with a bad taste in their mouth about the city of Birmingham, how they did things, and just going to be anti-democratic no matter what with that sentiment. Then you had Newt Gingrich and Contract of America. That's kind of at the height of the popularity of that and successes with that. I'd given some consideration to changing parties, even had the opportunity to change parties. Ellen Thomas came to me in December of 97 and told me that if I would change parties, he wouldn't run and that he would help me. Back then also, there was still a element of which I was a part of the Democratic Party that was conservative minded. If you look at my voting record during that 4 year track record, it was just as conservative as anybody's, and even more so than a lot of the Republicans. So, opted to remain a Democrat to be loyal to the people that helped me get there. In essence, the Yellow Dog Democrats had always voted Democrat out of tradition and based on philosophical, from the heart type issues, but conservative minded too. So I didn't want it, to me, it would have been a big slap in the face to those folks that helped me get to where I was. And I just opted to remain Democrat at that time. And had a lot to do with me not getting elected. So got caught up, in that wave, that Republican wave that year. Also got caught up, hung out on some local issues. It was just a no-win proposition that we're going to hit whoever was in office at the time. So, timing is essential in politics and very key. So timing of things is interesting sometimes. So so the short-lived one term, but it was a very good time, very fruitful time, I think, and met a lot of great people, still in contact with a lot of those folks today. I have since changed parties and opted to become a Republican. And I changed parties pretty much shortly thereafter. And have even sought re-election, election as a House member in the Republican primary. Once you've been elected as a Democrat, especially in this area, and you run in a primary scenario, it's a totally different deal, because they will brand you as the rhino, in essence, false, fake, whatever. But it was really my heart stand strong for conservative values. And
well, I know in 92 you challenged Ellen again. I didn't look up the vote total. Do you remember how
that would be 2002? No, I don't remember what the totals were, but I got wiped out pretty good. I mean, I don't remember exactly what it was.
And I know you've ran, I think you ran for state senate,
right?
I think a couple of times for the state house. And I think the last time, when Representative Sanders ran, and maybe my mind just did not read this right, but it seemed like there was only like 4,000, 6,000 votes cast. race?
Well, it was a special, maybe it was a special. I don't remember it myself either. You know, all this runs together. You know, I took the interview on the, I knew we were doing this, but if had I known, I didn't know if today was going to fall into place, but I could have done a little bit of research about that, but I don't remember.
Yeah,
but it was a special special election.
I should have done my research.
And, if it were a special election, likely you're correct, it probably wouldn't near as many votes as normal election cycle.
So, you know, one question I have for you, I mean, you know, been in business, you know, 50 years, everybody knows Jim Murphy. I mean, you seem like a super nice guy. You have your heart in place for Blount County. What happened? Did you make enemies in Montgomery that have had it out for you, that did not want you to be back in legislature?
Well, you know, a lot of it had to do with the timing, the Republican wave. The local newspaper was not very supportive of me, presented things very unique ways, different ways. And plus there were some local issues I got involved in that were related to some local elected officials that didn't particularly make them happy. So I don't think they were very supportive. But, you know, that's all been 25 years ago. Yeah.
So... And I have a couple of representatives come on that's going to meet with me. And I have a question that, you know, I want to know them. I'm interested in. We have a Republican governor, a Republican lieutenant governor, the judicial is Republican dominated, both houses are Republican dominated. How come we cannot get one bill passed?
What specifically are you referring to?
I mean, you know, we can get a gas tax bill passed. You know, I'm looking at now, I'm doing researching. Right now, what I found out is we have almost $5 billion missing from the COVID money that was given to the federal government. You know, I'm wanting to know what happened to that money. So we're taking money from more COVID to build prisons. Meanwhile, our Medicaid has not been funded. So we have rural hospitals that are now being closed. And it's like these guys cannot pass one bill down here, you know, regardless of what somebody's position is on medical marijuana. My opinion is lawless draconian, that we could have been making billions of dollars of tax money a year that could have funded just about anything you wanted. They can't even, it fails by one vote every time with that right there. We cannot get a lottery passed. I mean, maybe the time has passed that we've lost so much money. And I'm not really 100% saying that I support a lottery, because it's a backdoor tax. And it usually affects the people who can't afford it the most. You know, but if they're going to spend it in Georgia, you know, I'd rather them spend it in Alabama.
Well, as far as bills being passed, I don't know with, you know, those bills that you've alluded to, the lottery and others, seem that they take they're taken up. I was thinking the medical marijuana bill. I haven't kept in hands-on touch with exactly what's going on, what's passing, but I do know, you know, multiple dozens of bills are passed every year. There may be some big ones like the lottery that have been considered year after year and haven't passed, but I'm not familiar with exactly how many bills passed last session.
And that's one thing that bothers me too, is you know the gas taxes, and we're not funding Medicaid. And the COVID bill, I'm gonna write an article up on that. I want to find out what's going. Sorry, I won't keep you just a minute. Yeah. You're a busy man.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to wrap it up here pretty quick.
Oh, well, I appreciate you answering this. So, does Jim Murphy have one more race left in him?
No. No.
What about Mayor Vaniana?
No.
Well, Jim, I appreciate you giving me this opportunity. I'll get this put up on my YouTube account. You know, it's hard to get politicians and foreign politicians to sit down and talk with me, so it means a lot.
Well, we've been trying to get together for a while, so I appreciate your persistence in making it happen, and I hope it all goes well, and hope the best for you in the future, Chris. Thank you.
Thanks, you. Thanks a lot, Jim. I'm going to cut this off and start recording. I've got one more question.